Good morning, and thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be with you this morning and to celebrate with you. Thank you, Julie. I'm here, I think, probably because of Claire. That's her fault. She saw some pieces that I'd written. It actually was a compilation of thoughts which took place over time, over a period of time, and I put them together into a piece. And thanks, Paul. This is the basis of what I have brought along and what Claire saw. But I've modified it slightly because there's been further thinking, which I'll go into in what I say, around this whole subject. So it's structured in three parts, and I have the experience, some reflections and commentary on that, and I'm also picking up some of the texts which have been read today. And some of that might have been a bit surprising for you. Perhaps the Ecclesiastes reading was a bit of a surprise. I love Ecclesiastes. The wisdom theology that comes out of those passages is quite marvellous. But I'll try and make connections. It was about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM. It's almost impossible to comprehend the terrible devastation of the historic town of Yarloop or appreciate the trauma of trying to save it. Nor can one truly understand the sense of grief and loss experienced by the close-knit community or the challenges of its rebuilding. I wasn't there. We were the lucky ones. But the fire came close enough to experience the fear of fierce and uncertain danger, very close. On the morning of the 7th of January, we watched the sky to the north turn ominously dark, grey and brown, in ever higher bundles of smoke. The mix of overnight rain and ash left dark grey stains on the roof of the house and sheds. Alerts had already been issued on the radio and online. We'd planned to stay and defend. As we prepared ourselves for the expected fire front to reach us, we were confronted by a more immediate peril. A series of explosions on a major high-voltage power line caused by a build-up of ash on the insulators threw fireballs into our back paddock. A wall of flame erupted almost within minutes. Neighbours appeared with fire units to attack the fire, others equipped with no more than buckets, and then the welcome sound of a helicopter appearing overhead. It was under control for the moment. Whilst continuing to dampen down still-burning trees and embers, ember-filled stumps, we waited with rising anxiety as the smoke cloud above us turned a deeper grey ochre. Mopping up continued throughout the day. A loss of power late in the afternoon created new problems. Food preparation, light and house water became an issue. As night approached, the glow of still-burning logs and tree stumps was a warning of uncertain danger. At 4 AM, fanned by overnight winds, the embers became a new firefront. Calls were urgently made again for support, and in time the fires, which threatened to become a major front, were halted. As we fought the flames, we suspected, but didn't know then, Yarloop and surrounding farms was being destroyed, and many lives were at risk. Throughout the following day, we deconstructed a blazing haystack with our farm tractors, whilst waiting for our turn to meet the approaching front to our north. In rising fear and nervous anticipation, we prepared as best we could. By 7 on Thursday evening, the glow on the horizon was shrouded in thick smoke. Then we saw the river of flame pour down the hills towards us. As we watched, the apocalyptic mix of smoke, emerging flames, constant attack of low-circling helicopters, sounds of heavy earth-moving equipment, the flashes of blue and red of the fire units, the intermittent splutter of rain, and the sound of localized thunder and lightning created by the firestorm was almost enthralling. The front was halted. We had a reprieve. Others were not so fortunate, but many others were. It's odd how that happens, how chance prevails. We were still not out of danger, for after an overnight pause, the fire circling to our west turned and approached us from the opposite quarter. Harvey too became at risk and was evacuated. The euphoria and relief of safety and salvation, fueled by the last of one's adrenaline, is gradually replaced by an emptiness, grief, and sometimes anger. For those who loved Yarloop, it is much more, so much tangible and intangible community structure. So much history, both recent and past, will be difficult, if not impossible, to rebuild. But I believe many will try. There are many things which go through your mind when you must respond to urgent and immediate danger, or threat of danger. The circumstances in which we found ourselves are difficult to prepare for in the end, and in the end, circumstances choose the manner and timing of your actions. At the time, of course, the focus is simply on survival. But it's not only your own survival. It quickly becomes a shared experience which binds all into a common purpose. In the months since the fire, I have had time to reflect on the various stages of emotional and physical and practical reactions and the processes of recovery from it. I'm sure these are not much different from experiences of people caught up in similar situations, and there have been a number of serious or even catastrophic fires in recent years. However, this is the most serious since the dwelling up fires of the 1960s, and probably none of you are old enough as I am to remember those fires. What began as a practical process of recovery grew into a wider interest in how the affected community responded during the intensity of the event and afterwards. Some of it is documented in the reports which have now been republished, but not all of the stories, all of the real-time experiences of those who were directly caught up in it over the days and weeks which followed. Central to this is how individuals acted with such altruism and selflessness in fending off danger for their community and supporting their neighbours and people unknown to them, often at their own cost. There are many stories of people who remained to fight the fire, looking after the property of their absent neighbours. Some volunteers lost their homes as they worked to save others. In my own experience, I have people unknown to me arrive with whatever they had to help. The second point is the recurrent disconnect between the state authorities sent to manage the fire, to control the fire ground and its perimeter, particularly access to the area both in and out, and the residents it was tasked to defend. The clear miscommunication and inadequacy of information was a major problem. That's not to say that the men and women on the ground were not trying to do a good job, but the system itself largely failed. In the reading from Ecclesiastes, we hear, "Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. For if they fall, one will lift up the other." Community action, in other words, the urgency of youth, is more powerful than the slowness of authority. In an excellent book entitled A Paradise Built in Hell, American writer Rebecca Solnit examines the response of communities caught up in major disasters and how these two points play out, the capacity and natural humanity of community and the failure of state-organized systems to control and respond from the earthquakes and fire in San Francisco in 1906 through Mexico City's earthquake, the events of 9/11 in New York, and finally Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. What she concludes, amongst other things, is that the first and immediate response is from the community. Rather than panic and flight from fear, the quickly organized action to defend. Authorities are slow to respond, and then usually to act to control the expected panic, looting, and general disorder, which never eventuates. In San Francisco, the first response of the local military acted with the mayor's agreement, as though martial law was in place, and militiamen on the street shot down citizens and forced people out of their homes at gunpoint. I don't suggest that this was happening here, but police on the ground forced people out of their homes under an evacuation order including the threat of children being removed forcibly from their parents and being taken into state care. There is still anger in the community, particularly those who experienced the worst of the fire in Yarloop. The authorities have worked to clear debris and destroyed homes and to restore some order, but the suspicion and disillusionment from being ignored and undefended at the height of the fire remains. But it's not all like that. One other conclusion Solnit reached was the power of love expressed in full measure in disaster. In the first days after Hurricane Katrina, the most effective response was mounted by thousands of Americans who came with trailer boats, as well as the many community service and Christian agencies and informal community-based groups who came to distribute food, clothing, and kindness. It's usually in disaster that the most visible expression of love is seen. Dorothy Day was a child in the San Francisco fires. She said, "What I remember most plainly above the earthquake was the human warmth and kindness of everyone afterward. They gave away everything, every extra garment they possessed. They stripped themselves to the bone in giving, forgetful of the morrow. While the crisis lasted, people loved each other." Numerous writers have explored this love for society. Tom Paine, in his Rights of Man, suggests that there is a joy which comes from service to society, which is almost undescribable. Some part of this joy is found in disaster. In New Orleans, a number of informal aid groups sprang up. A former member of the Black Panther movement sat down with a group of friends and one had $20 and another $30. With that, they financed the organization called Common Ground. They started calling friends and in turn called friends. Millions of dollars would follow and was distributed. Originally mistrusted, they also bridged the gap of hate and suspicion between black and white. Day was not raised a Christian but converted to Catholicism. She deplored certain Christians who claimed to love God but did not love him in the poor and needy. She spoke up of the sense of solidarity which made me gradually understand the doctrine of the mystical body of Christ, whereby we are members one of another. It began with a phone call. Our neighbour noticed we had begun dropping our smoke-tainted grapes. A long and depressing task for the two of us, but the fruit was too damaged by fires to be used for vintage. She said, "Can you do with some help?" I protested. "No thanks, we can manage. Besides, there are many more people out there who need help, more than we do." The response was short but polite. "You do qualify, and if you don't mind, I'll put your name on the list." If you knew my neighbour, you would understand. You don't argue. She was one of the local community coordinators for the bushfire relief team. 20 minutes later, I had another call. "Brian here from Blaze Aid. I've got a crew looking for a job. They can come out in the morning. What time do you want them?" I hesitated. Do I want a bunch of unskilled do-gooders tramping over the property, needing tools fetched, morning tea and lunch, supervision and a cheery welcome? Brian's tone was polite but firm. I felt cornered. "Okay," I said, "I guess a few hours might help." Damaged fences, bare earth and scarred trees are a cheerless black companion for the spirit. Despair, weariness and uncertainty question everything. The confusion and grieving for lost order shape an uncertain prospect, and the urge to sit, unable to move. Questions were simple but confusing, the answers straightforward but complex, refusing to come. A line of four-wheel drive vehicles cruised into view at the appointed time in the morning, a team of smiling faces and fully equipped with tools, food, water and all essentials. They attacked the job in hand. One task rolled into the next and working with the team became engrossing. As we tidied the vines, rolled up damaged fences and cleared the fence lines of blackened trees, ready for rebuilding. The crew became individuals, each with a story. Dave, Gordon, Peter, Liz, Juanita and Nicole. Caring people who share the spirit of community and the gift of hospitality. Angels of grace from outback New South Wales, from the Sunshine Coast of Queensland, from Albany and from many other parts of Australia who brought the salvific balm of goodwill to nourish and to draw out the spirit from the dark tomb of the mind. Then Brian called again. We'd like you to join us in a meal on Saturday evening. Bring nothing. We will feed and entertain you. You will be with your farming neighbours. It was a simple meal, cooked and prepared by generous-spirited local volunteers and shared with joy with our worker friends. It took me some time, but in greater detail and clarity, the whole of the Easter story came to me. To experience what it meant to be the body of Christ and to see that reflected back in the faces of the people who came. The dying to what was before, the trauma of what was, and the compassion of those kind people to bring hope for the recovery and new beginnings. Stay with us, because it is almost evening and the day is nearly over. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened and they recognized him. Touch me and see. Have you noticed? Visible along the fire-ravaged sections of the highway, soft green shoots have emerged. On burnt trunks of gaunt trees, and closer to the ground, grass trees and smaller shrubs are throwing out brilliant sprays of lime and emerald. Even some less damaged trees have clusters of bright, fresh forest colours on branches and at the tips of grey lattice twigs. With the onset of rain, grasses are spreading a soft mantle over the blackened earth. But have you noticed? The most severely damaged trees, burnt black and hollowed out, lifeless limbs remaining twisted and deeply scarred. See, at the very base, bright tendrils of hopefulness are showing. These scarred old trunks stand testament to the fiercest trauma of the fires, but deep within the darkest soil lays the energy of renewal, resolutely drawn to the light and displaying the softest hues. The Christian message is that Christ's death on the cross shows that salvation comes from suffering. In major disasters, there is a possibility that catastrophe leads to social change. Adversity leads to progress, death and resurrection. Returning to Solnit, she says, the volunteers are evidence it doesn't take first-hand experience of a disaster to unleash altruism, mutual aid, and the ability to improvise a response. Many of them were part of subcultures, whether conservative churches or counterculture communities, that exist as something of a latent disaster community already present. The history of disaster demonstrates that most of us are social animals, hungry for connection, as well as for purpose and meaning. And two things matter most about these ephemeral moments. First, they demonstrate what is possible, or perhaps more accurately, latent. The resilience and generosity of those around us and the ability to improvise another kind of society. Secondly, they demonstrate how deeply most of us desire connection, participation, altruism, and purposefulness. thus the starting joy in disasters. The startling joy in disasters. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road?" Thank you.
Anyone got any questions or comments they'd like to make?
About six years ago, there were some severe fires that went through Margaret River, and the various fire agencies, you'll hear that I'm coming from a particular viewpoint here, did their best to put out the fires that happened, which were largely exacerbated by the community having resisted attempts to lower the fuel load. So FISA, Parks and Wildlife, the various authorities did their best. There was some loss of property, and the community were really angry with those firefighters. They were spat on. There was a real sense that the community had been let down. And it seems to me it's really simplistic to make this false, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but people do make this false dichotomy between the authorities on the one hand and the community. And it seems to me that the problem isn't with the authorities, because the authorities are composed of good people who try to do their best under incredibly difficult and worsening circumstances. It's our incapacity to organise. The fact is that we suffer from hubris, that we think that in moments of disaster that we have the capacity to pull all of our resources together, and the community is only one part of the resource. We just can't organise ourselves. We're humans, and the community expects too much, and the authorities expect too much. So my heart weeps for the loss of property and life and the anger, and I get that. But let's not, and I'm not saying you're saying this, but let's not cast the authorities into this amorphous mass, because they are composed of people trying to do their best as well. We just can't organise ourselves. We're just not that good. Mm. That's the point I make.
Yes, you're right. And I did make a comment in what I said, that it's not to say that there were not good things done, and that good people try to do good things, and I think the important point you're also making, and that is that the danger in and this is a question I was sort of dealing with in another context in another way about community. Question is, what do we mean by community? And I think, you know, there's all of this stuff here, but there's more than that as well. And, you know, it was lovely that you've actually structured the service and thoughts around these sorts of questions, because it is so important. In that instance and in all instances where there is this situation, there are a range of people who do their very best. And, you know, and some of those are heroic things that they do. And I was conscious of this question of criticism, but I was perhaps why I wanted to explore this question a bit further, and why I actually read this book of Solnit's, which looked at all of this. And there's a consistent theme which goes through it, and admittedly it's also at a much bigger scale, so you have to sort of make an adjustment as well. But the point she was saying, in a kindly way, I suppose, is that the system fails, not the individuals in the system, but the system fails. And the response is always to assume certain things, which actually, as a precondition, which is that in these events, the first response is flight and fear and chaos. Actually, when you are when individuals, and I would suspect even in the experience of the fire that you're talking about in Margaret River, when the individual on the ground is confronted with a situation, you respond, and you respond and organise yourselves as a local collection of people who might not otherwise be related in a very creative and cooperative way. Now, I say again, communities are different. You know, that what do we mean by community? And I suppose my experience is coming out of a rural community where people are very engaged and know each other very well, and perhaps another community may not respond in the same way. Anyway, that's a long response, but I think the point is an important one, and I thank you for making it.
Brian, I thank you. Simon, I should say. I thank you for delivering the message this morning, and I'm thankful for the comments about Brian's community spirit and the altruistic nature that he did in coming to and recovering your vines as best he could. And I'm thankful for the action of the community that where they got together. I hear what Paul's saying, and I've got many friends that fly the helicopters. Thank you.
I might say the real heroes in many respects are those helicopters.
They
Boy, if you see them fly those planes and what they do, it's absolutely remarkable what they can do.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Simon, I want to thank you. I was deeply moved by what you had to say. And my daily life, I'm working community development. That's what I do. And I do it in the suburbs. And listening to you, I think maybe we don't need consultants, we need disasters. But I don't mean that. Obviously, that's not what I mean. But what I do rejoice in the fact that within your comments about us being social and needing one another, and I guess it's finding ways that we don't need those disasters to unleash what you see as latent in those communities, because there are people in all our suburbs that are living very quiet, small disasters in their own lives. Yes. And needing that spirit that comes to the fore in disasters. So thank you for your very acute observations about the nature of people's responses. And I would encourage you to be sharing that wherever you can, so that we can continue to meet those very small, unheard-of disasters in people's lives. Thank you.
Look, I think that's a lovely, lovely thought that you have raised there, and I think that that's something which I would suggest is a very good takeaway point from today and what I've said here, is that we all of us live or can live individual little disasters, and it's how we respond to that, both personally and also in terms of that community, which is significant, and the same message. And I mean, it's a lovely kind of thought to take away. Yeah.
Simon, thank you. That I was moved very much by what you were saying, and I loved the connection with our spiritual walk and our relationship to God and others in the whole process. And I'm interested, a little bit like Paul, I guess, in the structural aspect of it all, in that, and I guess it's community as well, in that the fire services and the emergency services are in fact all part of our community.
Yes.
They form, and it's hard to know where the community stops and I guess the official government departmental bit starts with that sort of organisation, in that it sort of morphs from volunteers into the community to then at local government level having you know, your emergency service officers and so on, and then moving up into the broader fire and emergency services. And I'm wondering, in your comment about where you tend to promote a dichotomy between community and government agencies or authorities, whether we can actually do that, and whether did the where does the community stop, where do the authorities start? And I can understand the need to, from a community like Yarloop, to find areas of blame. You know, that's what we do. That's what the report tried to do, didn't it? To allocate who didn't do what they should do. Who, in your mind, I don't want you to talk about blame, but what could have been done better in that whole activity, in that whole experience, at the community or at the or at the agency level?
Look, there's certain aspects about Yarloop itself which I won't go into, because there's a bit of history which sits behind the town as well, it's a community which has felt uncared for. I'll leave it at that for some time, and so that has also fed into this. So there's particular aspects around that. You know, I'm cautious, and I'm sort of, in a way, sort of wanting to back out, because I'm very conscious of what Paul has said and challenged about the role of the agencies and the good work that they do. And it would take me too long, I suppose, to sort of unpick that a little bit and answer a little more the question. But I'll try a couple of points by example. I mean, the report itself, if you read the two reports that came out of that, the report itself says, and the findings of the report say, that the agencies involved, and the number of agencies involved, suffered in terms of the way in which they operated and communicated one to the other. And there is a discussion that's been going on here and will continue, and it's been in Victoria and in, I think, probably also New South Wales, between the country fire authority versus the state fire authorities, and the misunderstanding. And just for example, in sort of general terms, the state authority has certain criteria that it works to, and one of which is firstly protecting life, then protecting property. And the rest falls away from that. So you would have an example in a country, a rural environment, where the state authority is determining people are safe, major infrastructure is safe, therefore the fire can continue. The local authorities are saying, yes, but that's farming property, that's grasslands, that's all this sort of stuff. It's better to fight the fire face on and control it and stop it, rather than to allow it continue. So you'll have a situation where the local fire agencies are fighting here and the state authorities are sitting there because they haven't got instructions to actually do that. That's not their job. And so between them, between the parks authority that have their own criteria, you've got police who have their own criteria, you've got local organisations, local authorities who have their own criteria, and the failure to connect all of those. That's what I'm talking about in terms of the failure of systems. That's the sort of thing that Solnit is talking about. And what happens is that in the crisis, and I'm not talking in a generalised way, but in the crisis, it's those on the ground, the local community, who have vested interests in saving themselves and saving their neighbours, that act quickly, organise themselves quickly, and respond quickly. Yeah.
Simon, I want to say thank you as well. I'm over here. I'm a very concrete, wordy thinker, and partway through there I was very moved by what you had to say, and I don't know why. So I found it quite a powerful piece. Thank you. I've also got to thinking on this topic of organisation and community and whatnot, that In different situations, I find myself very quickly and easily falling down on the one side of the community or the people, or on the side of the organisation and the structure and the bureaucracy. And in whichever role I'm finding myself, I'm, you know, distrusting and disrespecting and whatnot the other. And I wonder if other people, other situations find this, outside of disasters even, which is, I've never faced a disaster like this. I wonder if people easily fall down one side or the other in that, and where progress can be made is where people can find that respect of the other. Like even the other night watching some Olympics where, some judges made a call which some people disagreed with and suddenly the atmosphere was terrible. And where respect is built for that thing that I don't really understand, if that's where we can make progress in disasters and life in general.
I guess I would just make a general comment, because what came to me in your question is one of the most powerful things that I was taught about, and I'm trying to remember, it was a workshop on non-violence, and in it is, I think, embedded the question that you've got, which is this sort of dichotomy that we find ourselves in. How do you break that division between this set of ideas and this set of ideas, and you pull those together? And I guess, again, in this question around organisation structure versus community and community response, is how do we get everyone talking to each other? And, in everything you sort of touch, it's not long before you come to a point of saying the essential question is communication. In this experience, in a practical and organisational sense, what ultimately failed was communication in a number of levels. And in the process of trying to communicate or trying to bring things together, there is one way, and probably it's the only way that has been devised, which is that you need to sit down and allow each other to tell their truth. And it's by telling each other's truths that you are working towards finding the greater truth. But unless you allow the other to speak their truth and allow me to speak my truth, and then find time to consider what that greater truth might be, then it's not going to work. And so, that's the essence of what we need to do, and I think it's embedded in pretty much everything that we struggle with in trying to make these connections, whether it's at a small scale or a larger scale. And so, again, your point is absolutely right. How do we construct something where we can talk easily and clearly to each other? Because language is such a difficult thing. What I say is not what you hear. You hear differently to what I say. We all do that because we bring our own values, our own judgments, our own those things which determine who we are into that conversation. It's not present, it's not obvious, but it's there. And so you've got to find a way to recognise and value that, but accept also that we are looking for something which is of even greater value.